From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Every now and again, we find something that deeply intrigues us, a painting, a story, a belief. We search for that compelling connection, seek it out. But what is it about that story, religion, or even food that engages us? The answer could lie within our brain and its evolution, scientific forces that make certain experiences appealing and others unremarkable. This hour on Point, understanding what is riveting to us. You can join us on air or online. What draws you to a painting or a song or a dance? What rivets you? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Ottawa, Canada, is Jim Davies, professor at the Institute of Cognitive Science at Carleton University, director of the Science Imagination Laboratory there. He writes the blog The Science of Imagination for Psychology Today. He's the author of the new book, Riveted, The Science of Why Jokes Make Us Laugh, Movies Make Us Cry, and Religion Makes Us Feel One with the Universe. You can find an excerpt from his book on our website, onpointradio.org. Jim Davies, welcome to On Point. Nice to have you.
Hi, Jane.
So tell us what intrigued you about this area of research.
I've been an artist my whole life in as an amateur in theater and painting and other kinds of things. And as I trained to be a scientist, I got a real interest in whether some of the things that people would teach in the arts would be scientifically testable. So the arts are full of lots of folk wisdom and like this works and this doesn't work and here's why. And I thought, well, maybe science could speak to this. And I had to put that passion on hold for many years as I was training in my graduate studies. And then finally, when I became a professor, I had a chance to start looking into it and discovered all the research there is on art and aesthetics and all that kind of thing. And then I started to notice that also in the cognitive science of religion, there are also studies of why religion is compelling, and I noticed that there were some of the same reasons. So I started pursuing this idea of a general theory of what compels us and what do we find riveting.
Well, let's get into some of those reasons, and we'll talk about each category specifically throughout the hour. But as you say, you tied together research from fields of psychology and philosophy and anthropology and biology, I think it was, computer science, religious studies, to get at the underpinnings of these sort of subconscious reactions, whether it's music or art or sports. What did you discover? What did the science say?
Well, the science says a lot, which this is why it had to be a book-length idea.
Give us the headline, and then we'll unpack
it. I think the
it.
Most relevant thing is that our brains interpret media of various kinds as real, many parts of our brains. So the reason we cry at movies and the reason we see people on the screen rather, and we perceive them as people rather than just as light on a screen is because the basic machinery of face perception and understanding language and all that stuff doesn't distinguish between whether something is actually right in front of us or whether it's a representation of it. So we can get these emotional reactions to things that strictly speaking, aren't real. And in our newer, the deliberative conscious parts of our brains, we can say to ourselves, oh, it's only a movie. But that, as we all know, can't stop us completely from being scared at a horror movie or from finding a story very sad.
Hmm. So the old brain in the back of our heads, you write, by the brainstem, helps us survive, helps us reproduce. We share some of that old brain anatomy with other animals. But the new brain in the front of our head controls the impulses of the older brain. I think that I've got that right from your
book.
That's
basically right.
Right? So these two brains are sort of, at battle with one another?
They can be. And that is a really interesting situation to be in. Sometimes people can feel that they like something, but they know better. For example, you might find a joke funny, but at the same time think it's offensive. Or you don't want to like something, or you wish you liked something better than you do. So yes, they can be in conflict. Often they're not in conflict and you have good reasons. And then a lot of the times you get these very deep subconscious impulses that you like something or don't like something. And then without even realizing it, your conscious mind rationalizes and comes up with an explanation that you believe is the cause of your feelings, but is actually the other way around.
So give me a real example of this. This is sort of all sounds kind of sciencey to me. Give me a real practical example of what you're talking about.
Well, I think when people have self-interest involved with something, okay, they might... Here's a great example. You can ask a bunch of people, if you are falsely accused of a crime, then they should have to pay your legal fees, for example. And lots of people will agree with that. But if you put it a different way, if you accuse someone of something and they win, you should have to pay their legal fees. And it's the same question. It's the same, you know, question about law policy. But if you frame it in terms of whether it's you doing the paying or you getting the money, people have reliably different opinions on the matter. People don't realize that they are being influenced by a selfish desire. I mean, selfish is strongly put, but a self-interested desire to, get ahead in the world. And they just think they're being rational about it.
And so then what's going on scientifically in the brain while that's happening?
Well, you get different parts of your brain are working on what you're experiencing all the time in parallel. So the older part of your brain might recognize a threat. It's like, oh, geez, I would have to pay all this money. I don't want that. And then you get this negative emotion and your rational, you know, the more deliberative part of your brain might start coming up with, you know, churning up reasons why this is a bad idea. Or the other way around, it's like, oh, this is a good thing. This is really good. And you start looking for reasons why.
You write in the book, for example, here, the new brain can know that, for example, prepackaged cupcakes are unhealthy. But your old brain can be quite insistent that they should be devoured, all of them, with a cold glass of milk. Because evolutionarily, the brain knows that sugar and fat are scarce and should always be eaten when the opportunity arises. It doesn't know that fat, sugar, and salt are also causing a huge obesity problem in the industrialized world. Another example of what you're talking about, I guess.
Right. Food's a very clear example of this. So, exactly. You have these tastes and you can't really change your tastes, and your knowledge that that you should or shouldn't have something is right there alongside it.
You write that understanding an experience seems to reduce the emotional strength of the experience. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, this is something that a lot of scientists over the years have said, they've said the opposite, actually. They don't think that explaining something will affect how much you appreciate it or think it's beautiful. So, a lot of artists don't like the idea of picking everything apart to its little bits, and that sort of kills it. And I agreed with the scientists for a while, but then I started looking at the research, and it turns out that actually one of the things that makes things really compelling is that your mind struggles with it. So when you try to understand something and you're struggling to understand it, you can be very interested for a long time. And then it turns out that once you feel like you really understand it, your mind can let it go, and it ceases to become riveting. And I'll give you an example from my own life. Back in the late 90s, I was watching the X-Files television show, for listeners who remember that show. And there are lots of mysteries in that show, and I liked it. And then the movie came out, and I watched the movie. And I loved the movie because it tied up so many mysteries that the show had brought up. But then a really interesting thing happened. After the movie, I had no desire to watch the show anymore. That it answered so many questions that my mind was able to let it go and stop wrestling with it. And sometimes when you see a film, recently Prometheus came out, and it doesn't make a lot of sense, but people spend a lot of time trying to figure it out. So likewise, when you eat a cupcake and you or watch a horror movie, you might get a really positive feeling or a really negative feeling about it. But if you explain why you like the cupcake or why the horror movie scared you, the very act of coming up with explanations for these things attenuates the feeling you get. It makes the feeling less strong because your mind is able to sort of shelve it and move on to the next thing. Our minds are very curious and always looking for something to understand, and it doesn't want to waste time thinking about something that is completely understood.
Give us another example of that. I find that fascinating.
Another example is, let's take sports, for example. So incongruity, like when you're watching a game, even if you are a big fan of one of the teams, the game is more riveting and interesting if the scores are close. So on the one hand, you might like it if your team demolished every other team, but the truth is that people are much more riveted to a game that is close because they don't know what the outcome is going to be. So they will pursue knowledge that is unknown. Where the outcome is known, it's not as interesting to people.
One of the goals of your book, you say, is to help people understand how their own minds work so that they can make better decisions. Can you talk about
right.
that?
Right. Well, there are a lot of ideas out there that are, frankly, very beautiful and very, very compelling. And they might not be compelling for great reasons. And, you know, some of them are and some of them aren't. And I'm hoping that with the book, people will understand what makes themselves tick. And by knowing what people tend to find riveting, you can sometimes give a little more criticism to an idea that appears really beautiful. So if someone tells you an idea, I remember when I was in college, a student said to me, well, I believe that life on Earth started because a meteor landed and it had life forms on it and, you know, that caused the Earth to have life. And it's like the sperm and the egg. And that metaphor made it beautiful to her. And that beauty was, is part of what drives her to believe it, and maybe perhaps in spite of any scientific evidence, for example.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking this hour about what drives human intrigue. We're joined this hour by Jim Davies, professor at the Institute of Cognitive Science at Carleton University. His new book is called Riveted, The Science of Why Jokes Make Us Laugh, Movies Make Us Cry, and Religion Makes Us Feel One with the Universe. You can find an excerpt of his book on our website, onpointradio.org. I'd like to bring another voice into the conversation. Now, joining me from Washington is Kevin Blackistone, professor of journalism at the University of Maryland, sports writer. He's also a frequent panelist on ESPN's Around the Horn. Kevin, welcome back to On Point. Nice to have you again.
Thanks for the invite, Jane.
So what do you make of this research? You follow these things. What do you think?
Well, it's, it's interesting. I always think of what I learned when I was in high school about religion, because I went to a Catholic high school, and that religion is somehow the explanation of the inexplicable. And so I think that's what I think of in this book. And obviously, in this country and around the world, there is one thing that people seem to get riveted to for any number of reasons. That's sports, which Professor Davies mentions quite a bit in his book. And I was thinking about that just this weekend, because there is something that everyone in sports and now beyond sports is riveted to, and that's this horrific death in NASCAR over the weekend of a 20-year-old sprint car driver who was killed by a car driven by a NASCAR superstar in Tony Stewart. And so I was wondering, from Professor Davis's standpoint, not only sports but tragedy, and why so many of us seem unable to turn away from something so horrific.
Jim.
Right, yeah. So there's a very large literature about what's a negativity bias, and we're very attuned to negative information. We pay more attention to it, we remember it better, and all this kind of stuff. And I think the reason is that we're learning about the world when we pay attention to bad things that happen to people. Like if someone dies in a car, then, that's a little bit of data that our mind uses to assess risk in our own lives. I think the real mystery is, why do we care about tragedies and danger and bad things happening to people far away with lives very, very different from ours? And the answer, I think, is to return to what I was saying earlier, is that a lot of our minds don't realize that what we're watching on TV or what we hear about in the news isn't happening in our community, in something very close to us. So we end up paying attention to tragedies and dangerous things happening all over the world, and our minds just can't get enough of it.
Talk about tragedies. Let's go back to some sporting analysis. Kevin, you brought that up. Here's some sound just last month from the World Cup, when millions of Americans and people around the world tuned in to those games. This is round two of a match. Jermaine Jones scoring for the USA against Portugal, tying up the game in the second half.
Jones. Oh, yes! Jermaine Jones! What a cracker from him! USA level!
These games drew millions and millions of viewers, Jim. What is it about sports and events like this that people find so compelling?
Oh, there's lots of stuff. I think one of the great things about the World Cup is that it exemplifies people's sense of in-group loyalty. And, of course, every sports fan knows that a game is much more interesting and riveting if you have a skin in the game, if you really care about one of the teams winning or not. And you might identify very strongly with a team, and then that, you know, makes you want to pay a whole lot of attention. This gets back to a lot of symbolic competition that we see across a lot of animal species. And when you identify with somebody, then you, in some sense, feel that they are competing on your behalf. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the great things about, like, the World Cup.
The odd thing is that just a few weekends ago at the University of Michigan, we had 109,000 people turn out for a friendly from the English Premiership, and it was the largest live audience ever for a soccer game in this country. But no one here is tied into either of the teams that played there. No one is from England that right. I know of in Michigan.
Right.
So why would they be so compelled to turn out for a game for which the outcome means absolutely nothing, and for which most of the star players weren't even participating?
Yeah. There are other reasons that people like sports. Another one of them is that there are these parts of our minds that are activated similarly, whether you are engaging in a physical activity or watching it. And for that part of our minds, when we are watching something happen, it could be sports or it could be dancing or anything else, part of our minds really think that we're doing it. And we get this little bit of a vicarious thrill. And if you measure people's very subtle motor movements, like little twitches of their muscles, they are in some kind of accordance with what you're watching. Part of the reason we like to watch sports is the reason that we like to play sports, is that it gives us this little bit of a vicarious thrill. But competitions of all kinds are really interesting. And the sports that involve competition on the same field, all right, basketball, hockey, something like that, are more popular in general than sports like weightlifting or high jump, where the competition is sort of in the numbers after the fact, because competition in general is something we find fascinating. And the reason for that is because our minds are very attuned to the social structure that we see around us, and people winning and losing, who's winning and losing and who's getting to the top of the social hierarchy is very important information in a social context. And we want to know who's in charge and who's going to end up in charge and who's friends with whom. So when you see a bunch of people competing with something, our minds have a very instinctual interest to know who's going to win it.
Hmm. Let's get a caller in here. Matthew is in Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, Matthew. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Thanks for this very interesting topic. I had a couple of questions or subjects, I guess, to bring into the conversation.
Okay.
One is the topic of pathos, which is finding a subject or something that is just so bad or contemptible that you find it compelling in spite of yourself, which is, I think, an interesting phenomenon. And the other question I had is how we're sometimes compelled to see something over and over again. And what prevents us from getting tired of something? I mean, there are certain movies that I can just see again and again, and I just never get tired of them for whatever reason.
Matthew. Give us an example.
Well, if I happen to be flipping around, if one of the Godfather films is on, I can't help but watch it because the performances are amazing. It's evocative of a certain era, but I've probably seen it at least 10 times. The Godfather 1 and 2. Number 3 is terrible, as you know. But anyway, that's just one example among many. But why don't we get tired of certain things? That's
a great question, Matthew. Thanks so much for calling. Jim Davies.
Yeah, that is a great question. And, you know, there's a very interesting studies of museum curators and what they find in what they find great about the great works of art. And they call them bottomless. And the idea is that you learn things about it and you just, you know, discover things about it, but it never stops giving. There are complexities that reveal themselves with further investigation. And that is what draws people in. And that is what they say differentiates the great works of art from other ones that are perhaps merely pretty. So you can look at a butterfly's wing and you might say, oh, that's really lovely. But you can bore of that if you don't find anything else there, if there's not, there aren't more hidden mysteries to get at. So they say with you know, the great works of art, that you will continually get something new out of it. And I would expect that for the first many times you watch a great movie, you see new things about it that you like a whole lot. And that might not be true for this caller. You know, watching The Godfather over and over again, at a certain point you might not be learning anything new from it, but you were also, you know, sometimes just reminded of the great times you've had watching it before.
What about Matthew's other question about the hathos, the something that's so odd or bad that it compels your attention despite yourself?
Right. So I'm not sure I really understand the question. Is it about bad things happening to people?
I think it's the idea that something that an idea is so bad or so. I'm not quite sure. I think Matthew's off the phone now. But
yeah. Well, okay. So I'm somebody who's a fan of watching disastrous performances on YouTube, for example. I can watch somebody try to do something and fail at it so badly that I like, you know, I watch it again and again and I find it very funny. And these there's a whole genre of fail videos that are very, very popular. And even before the internet, the America's Home Videos, a lot of those videos were people screwing up, falling over, this kind of thing. And again, I'll return to the fact that we watch in part to learn, and we are attracted to negative information, and part of us is trying to learn about what parts of the world are safe and not, and what we can do and what we can't do by watching other people mess up.
Kevin Blackistone, you want to jump in here?
Well, I'm thinking about that. Attracted to, I think you used the term before, negative bias.
Negativity bias.
And what we can learn from that. And so I'm thinking about that in terms of sports. And when we see people commit huge errors in games that are extremely costly, and how they become almost these iconic moments within sports, I guess that is something that relates to what it is you just explained.
Right. I mean, you might not be paying attention to a NASCAR, but as soon as there's an accident, everybody pays attention.
Right.
Let me get another clip in here and turn our attention to the cultural intrigue about celebrity. Here's a clip from the movie Mean Girls, where students are paying particular attention to the celebrity at their school, Regina George.
Regina George is flawless. She has 2 Fendi purses and a silver Lexus.
I hear her hair is insured for $10,000.
I hear she does car commercials in Japan.
Her favorite movie is Varsity Blues.
One time she met John Stamos on a plane,
and he told her she was pretty.
One time she punched me in the face. It was awesome.
So, Jim Davies, you talk about this a lot in your book. Why is it important for us to pay attention or to gather information on popular people or celebrities or people with high social status?
Right. So if a lot of our brains and minds don't understand that what we're looking at is not right in front of us, for example, a televised image or a story that we're hearing in the news, we don't realize that that's not right in front of us and part of our community, then we treat people with prestige of any kind with the same kind of interest that we would leaders of our own peer group or community. And in the time that humans have been humans, we've lived in these hierarchically organized societies, or even if there isn't a hierarchy, it's very important to know who's in charge and who owes whom a favor. So we get very interested, particularly in the people in power, the people who are beneath us in the social status. They're not as important to pay attention to. So what we do is we, our minds thinking that it's really important to know what happened to the royal couple or something like that, we end up feeling this really strong sense of importance to watch what they do and pay attention. Now, why would we pay attention to people with prestige? Well, one, these theories are speculative, okay? So one of them might be that we want to learn what they're doing right. What are they? Maybe it's because of something they're wearing. Maybe it's because of the way they're acting or talking. And you see people imitating celebrities on TV. Everyone remembers the Friends Jennifer Aniston haircut that was really popular for a long time. You know, why would people imitate the haircut of a television star? Perhaps at some level, our minds think that that is maybe what made her successful. That might be one of the reasons.
Let's go to Birmingham, Alabama, and Jim, who's on the line. Jim, welcome. Thanks for waiting. You're on.
Greetings. Fascinating topic, and it's somewhat of a challenge for me personally. I'm a longtime human spaceflight exploration advocate, and I've found that, you know, it's quite a task to maintain that mystique that keeps people interested. First of all, let me go back to that sports analogy. We were talking about televised sports and YouTube. It's interesting that our big sports channel, their video of the year was that fabulous kick six play in the Auburn-Alabama game where with 1 second left on the clock, a field goal came up short, and Chris Davis, the great Auburn football player, returned that short kickoff 109 yards for a touchdown, and it was the biggest hit on YouTube for weeks after that. that was 28 years after Alabama kicked a long field goal and won the game, and the Auburn fans turned the tables in 1 second. But going back to the 1960s, like I say, I've been a human spaceflight advocate for a long time. I remember the morning getting up and looking in the newspaper after Mariner 4 flew to Mars. And before that, Mars was a mysterious place. All we had was blurry telescopic images of Mars. But when Mariner 4 sent back the first digital images of the Martian surface, we saw that it was a cratered landscape looking a lot like the moon. Well, that immediately killed the mystique that people had about Mars. And it became very hard for NASA to get funding for Martian exploration. A similar thing happened after Neil Armstrong's step on the moon, July 20th, 1969. After people stayed up on that Sunday evening and watched that first step on the moon, and they saw that the moon looked, well, it looks a lot like the high desert of the western United States, only there's no cacti and there's craters, TV ratings for the space cover missions began to decline immediately after that. And you know, that was an issue mentioned in the movie Apollo 13, which was historically accurate. People lost interest because seeing Neil Armstrong step on the moon took the mystique out of it. You know, that was the goal of the program set by President Kennedy. And it was very hard to justify the follow-up landings and after that.
Jim, thank you. What a great call and some great remembrances there. Jim Davies, go ahead.
The caller, Jim, is hitting on a very important point about drawing our interest. Their curiosity. Curiosity is absolutely crucial for people's interest in things like space exploration. And something needs the promise of understanding to get us and keep us interested. There can be a lot of information. We don't know how all those craters were formed, but looking at a cratered surface, it doesn't look like there's anything more to learn. And if it doesn't look like there's anything more to learn, we switch off.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're in the middle of a great conversation about what rivets us. We're joined by Jim Davies, professor of cognitive science and author of the new book Riveted, The Science of Why Jokes Make Us Laugh, Movies Make Us Cry, and Religion Makes Us Feel One with the Universe. You can find an excerpt of the book at our website, onpointradio.org. Also with us is Kevin Blackistone, professor of journalism at the University of Maryland, sports writer and frequent panelist on ESPN's Around the Horn. We've got a lot of calls here. Let's go to Storm in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Hi, Storm. Glad you waited. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
As an electronic music producer and DJ, I witness and, you know, I have to deal with human intrigue all the time. I play music out that people wouldn't normally hear on their own. They wouldn't normally seek it out themselves. And when they hear it, like, they don't know what to expect next. When I'm in the mix, they might hear something and they're waiting, you know, they're intrigued. They're waiting for something else. Like, they know something else is coming, and that's why they stick around. That's why it keeps them interested, I guess. Rhythms and sounds that they're not familiar with.
And sounds and patterns, right?
Well, yeah, even, like, you got regular rhythms, you know, everybody can get down to, like, you know, just a 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, but when it's like 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, like, if you're throwing a rhythm around, polyrhythms, if you're hitting things, if you got a song where it's not what anybody was expecting, that's when the people lose it. That's when a sound comes in, the disgusting sound. It sounds like a robot, like, dying or something. Somebody hears something like that, and then a break comes in. People just lose it. They just don't. I'd say it's so far out of their comfort zone that they're in their comfort zone. Like, they're comfortable with it, and they just start dancing because everybody's dancing. It's a strange phenomenon.
Well, let me play some music here, Storm. Thanks so much for the call. Here's one you've probably played yourself. And I want you to listen to the layers of music in this clip from Skrillex's song, Monsters and Nice Sprites. That's Skrillex, for all those who recognize that piece. Jim Davis, you say patterns are so important when it comes to humans engaging with music in particular. Why is that?
I'm so glad that an electronic dance music DJ called. Because I think that electronic dance music is possibly the best example of the relationship between pattern and incongruity that I can think of. And those are two chapters in the book, a whole chapter on pattern and incongruity. So what you even heard in that clip that you played is that you've got some sounds and it plays for a while, and after you start to get used to it, just as you're starting to get used to it and potentially bored of it, something new comes in, the voice, a bass line, something like that. And then maybe 8 or 16 bars later, something else comes in. And music, the compellingness of music is all about manipulating your expectations, violating them in certain ways, but not too much. What the caller said was that you got to give them something that, you know, is completely unexpected and they've never heard before. And I think that I know what he's getting at. And I think that he's right in that you have to surprise people a little bit, at least, to keep them interested. However, you can't surprise them with just anything. You can't just have white noise for a half an hour. White noise has an enormous amount of new information. Every little sound is completely unpredictable. What is uninteresting about it is that it doesn't have any promise of finding any order. For the same reason that the surface of Mars, a bunch of craters, doesn't interest us, white noise doesn't interest us. So the new things that a song or a DJ will introduce over the course of time has to fit the space of things that we are expecting and violate them just enough.
This notion of manipulating expectations, Kevin Blackistone, is really interesting to me based on what Jim just said.
Yeah, it is. But I think about my own musical taste, and I prefer jazz, and I particularly prefer creative jazz or avant-garde jazz, which probably violates any rules of music more than any music. And yet, it must be beyond that threshold because most people are not drawn to it, and most people who listen to it, if they haven't listened to music in a progressive sense, are so stunned by it that they're turned off by it.
There must be some
point at which the destruction of what you expect is too destructive.
That's absolutely right, and I think that. I'm not sure exactly what kind of jazz you listen to, but there are certainly forms of music that people listen to that other people think are much too repetitive, and much, there's not enough going on. There's not enough there. And then some people, like even myself, I have a CD of John Coltrane, but I can't I can't make sense of it. To me, it's too much like noise. I can't get a grip on it. And I don't doubt that if I spent years studying it, I'd be able to figure it out. But for me, it just doesn't work. And it's tough to, you know, try to understand why some people go for that and others don't. I have some ideas, but it's still pretty unknown.
And one other question I just have, when you, Jane, when you were mentioning celebrity, of course, the first celebrity that jumped to mind for me in terms of attraction, I'm trying to figure out why the attraction, is Kim Kardashian. Why?
I'd love to talk
really,
so many
Kevin.
People.
Really,
I would love to talk about why people are attracted to Kim Kardashian. So now there's this idea going around that some people are famous for being famous, and I think that is a little bit. I think there's some truth to that. In that, once somebody is famous and has prestige, people pay attention, and it can be a cycle that sort of fulfills itself and feeds on itself. But there is no doubt that a lot of people find Kim Kardashian absolutely beautiful. So that's not hurting her career, okay? and then she is on television doing things. That's when it starts to feed on itself. Everyone starts, if everyone watches it, perhaps at first because she's attractive, and then they start paying attention to the minutia of her life. And then she marries somebody else who's also famous, and it is this perfect storm of prestige, famous, and then people want to know about them for various reasons. I'll also talk a little bit in terms of celebrity about contagion. Another interesting celebrity worship phenomena is that people want to collect various junk that celebrities have owned. Mm. This, you know, Kurt Cobain's guitar, or this is the rag that Tom Waits wiped his brow with in a certain concert. And this has a really interesting scientific background. It derives from our ideas of negative contagion, like of a infectious disease. So we don't want to touch people who are visibly very sick. We have an aversion to doing so. But it also turns out that we have some positive contagion too, and people seem to think that some good is going to rub off on them by touching something that is has some kind of appeal to it like that. So they want to, you know, they want to hold it, they want to touch it. Going back to the space exploration, you can look at moon rocks. I can tell you that the moon, most moon rocks are almost indistinguishable from, you know, rocks in the parking lot. But if you saw one, you might want to touch it. You might want to hold it. You know, and that's kind of mysterious.
Let's get to Joan in Hartsville, South Carolina. Hi, Joan. Glad you called.
Hi, Jane. Thanks. I'm a professional musician myself, so I was really interested in what the last caller had to say. But I've done classical music all my life, and I haven't heard any words come up on the show so far about things like addiction, serotonin, dopamine. I know that, you know, some people like seem to be addicted to watching a certain sport, and, you know, I would call it an addiction almost. And is that really, are these kind of addictive things?
Right. What's the link? What's the difference between what's compelling and what's addicting? Joan, thanks so much. Jim Davies, an interesting point.
It is. And addiction is one kind of compellingness. And one of the things I try to get across in the book is to be wary of the difference in your own life. And, of course, serious addictions in the medical sense are very serious concerns that need to be treated and all this. But I think there are more mundane kinds of addictions in everyday life that people have that they should really pay attention to. So, for example, sometimes you might open up a bag of potato chips and eat one or two and really like it. Oh, it tastes great. Oh, these are delicious potato chips. But then you should ask yourself, 15 minutes later watching TV and you are just mindlessly eating these potato chips, are you still really enjoying it? Or are you only driven to eat more? And certain video games are very addictive. You open boxes on the screen, and sometimes they have gold and sometimes they don't. And you should really sit back and ask yourself, am I actually having fun, or is it just that I cannot stop? Hmm. And when people describe, often in my social community, it's about video games, like, oh, it's so addictive. And that, when I hear that now that I've done all this research, I think to myself, okay, that doesn't mean it's fun. Mm-hmm. It might be that it's just forcing you, like a compulsion, to keep on doing it because you feel that you need to, rather than because you want to come back to it because you actually enjoy it.
Yeah. Joan, thanks so much for that call. Here's Justin in Atlanta, Georgia. Hi, Justin. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thanks. Mm-hmm. One of the things I want to return to is the idea of what's compelling and that which is mysterious. And what came to my mind was the Christian doctrine of the Trinity, which is one of the most important ideas and most generative in Western history. And it's so part of what's appealing about it is it's kind of contradictory nature that God could be both one and God is also three, that God is utterly transcendent, and that God is also exactly like you and I, that this idea was very generative in Western history. I'd like to know what you all think about that.
Thanks. Justin, thank you. I'm glad you brought us back to religion, because that is a big piece of your book, Jim Davies.
Yes. Religious scripture in particular is written in a way that is open to multiple interpretations. And the way that people read scripture, studies show, is that they, if they believe in the religion, for example, they will not read it with a critical eye. What they do is they read it assuming that the text is true, but what they're looking for is the interpretation that speaks to whatever issue they're dealing with. And it is important that religious texts be that ambiguous for it to be successful. If the text is too clear and it says something, let's say it says that God lives on the top of, you know, Zeus lives on top of Mount Olympus and it's this physical mountain and if you climb up, you'll see him. Those kinds of things are so specific that, they can just be falsified immediately. Daniel Dennett, a philosopher in cognitive science, wrote a book called The Mind's Eye, and one of the publishers said, it's too clear to become a cult book. So this mystery, the idea of the Trinity, is supposed to be mysterious. They want it to be mysterious. They don't want your mind to let it go. And just like I couldn't stop watching The X-Files or people want to watch Lost, certain kinds of contradictions that people claim are true can just fascinate us endlessly, trying to make sense of it and trying to understand it.
So much here. Let me get another caller in because we have many. Yellow Springs, Ohio. Tatiana is on the line. Thanks for waiting. Glad you called. Hello.
Hi, Jane. Hi. So I'm here with my friend, and we've been thinking about like what's riveting to us and what compels us emotionally. And we've been thinking about nature, and I'm kind of surprised that it actually hasn't come up yet, but nature is definitely something that's very mysterious, and there's a lot of human connection to it and even, like, religion surrounding it. And so, you know, we've just been thinking about how can we get people to recognize that, like, emotional connection that is, like, available with nature.
Mm. And how to sort of get an emotional appeal behind nature instead of approaching it from a scientist's point of view or always, like, an activist point of view, but, like, really how to bring forward the emotion that you feel on a human level and make other people realize that nature is the most inescapable, like, riveting thing that exists.
Yep, Tatiana, thank you. How do we get people to be really compelled to do good, to help the environment in this case, to do something broadly to help society? Jim Davies.
Yeah, that's a complicated question. On the one hand, people do have a natural affinity to nature, and people are calmed by outdoor scenes with water and clouds and this kind of thing. But on the other hand, just a random picture of trees is not as interesting to many people as a song or something that was an artifact created, a work of art that's been created. A lot of what we find fascinating about nature are those kinds of things that correspond to what we find interesting in human lives. So if you hear about an ant colony that makes slaves out of other insects, that's riveting to us because we know about slavery. We've heard of that. We think it's terrible, and now ants are doing it. And people might find that a lot more compelling than, say, the latest finding on the material properties of a certain structure that doesn't really have much to do with human life. Mm-hmm. So we are wired to be interested in things that are historically been relevant I mean, evolutionarily in a very long time, relevant to our own survival and reproduction, these kinds of things. And the real struggle is getting people interested in the parts of nature that don't match up with that. Mm-hmm. So the panda, people love pandas. They're adorable. They're cute. But there are a lot of other animals that are more important for the ecosystem that we have a hard time raising money mm-hmm. to try to save.
Kevin Blackistone, jump in here in our last minute. Give us your thoughts.
Well, one thing I wanted to ask Jim about was this idea of how culture, I think you wrote about how it impacts compellingness.
Right.
I'm just trying to figure out how that, so different cultures may be more compelled towards different things than others. Is that
possible? Yeah, absolutely. Well, for one thing, no matter how good a Russian novel is, if you don't speak Russian, you can't appreciate it, right? So that,
right.
At that level. But then there are other art forms that require a lot of learning to be able to understand what they're about. And so your cultural background that you bring to things allows you to see the problems and the solutions that the artwork comes up with to be able to understand it. So culture really does drive it.
It's so fascinating. Thank you very much to both of you for this wonderful hour. Kevin Blackistone is professor of journalism at the University of Maryland, also sports analyst for ESPN. Kevin, thanks so much. I'll think of you whenever I see Kim Kardashian now.
Thanks, I think.
Also, Jim Davies, author of the new book, Riveted, The Science of Why Jokes Make Us Laugh, Movies Make Us Cry, and Religion Makes Us Feel One with the Universe. Just terrific writing, Jim. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jane.
Listeners, thanks to you as well. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.